This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. War reaches you psychologically, even if the fighting is several miles away. My guest, Slavinka Dragalic, is a journalist who lives in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia. This is about 40 miles from the fighting in Bosnia. We called her at her home in Zagreb to find out how her life and her city are being changed by the war. Dragalic is currently completing a book of essays about the war between the countries that were once held together as Yugoslavia. She's also the author of a recent collection of essays called How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, and she has a new novel called Holograms of Fear. Last fall, a couple of sites were bombed in Zagreb, and there were up to 18 air raids a day. Now she says things may look comparatively normal, but they're not.
If you would come to Zagreb, what you would see is a kind of totally schizophrenic life. You would go to the bookstore, you would buy books, you go to the store, you would buy food, there is everything to buy. You would go to the coffee and you would just sit there and have your coffee and you would sip your coffee in peace. But at the same time, you would know that the front line is very nearby, you wouldn't hear anything. What you would see is the refugees. There is a lot of refugees in the city. And you would see the poverty of the city. You would see that this city is different than a year ago or 2 years ago. So it is happening in a different way. The war to Zagreb is happening in a different way, I would say, as much as to me, because I personally haven't been touched by destruction or by death. But I think it changed me entirely from within.
There are thousands of refugees now in Zagreb. One of them is a close friend of yours who is a journalist from Sarajevo who fled Sarajevo in late April. What has it been like for you to see her as a refugee?
First of all, it has been painful because it's a friend and it's a colleague, and she is a single mother, and she escaped on the last day when it was possible to escape from Sarajevo by normal means of transportation. And it was just the day before her daughter's sixth birthday. So it was really painful to see that, but we took a good care of her. We put her in an apartment. She stayed first with a friend, and then we found an apartment for her. She now has even a job here as a journalist. She's a correspondent to the Bosnian newspaper, and there are difficulties, of course, to send the reports there. And so, I mean, you know, in terms of practical everyday things, I think things are okay. There are about 200,000 of refugees, I think, in the city of Zagreb. So you can see them everywhere, and you can feel them, you know, being in the city. You can feel them. You can see in the streets who is a refugee or not.
How can you tell?
Well, because the way they are dressed, and also by the accent, by the way they speak, and also there are some gathering points where you can meet them, like a Moscow, for example. And also by the way they wander the streets, because these people don't have anything to do. They are frightened. They are lost. You know, this is the big city, and you know people are not always very friendly to them. This is one of the phenomenon of this war of schizophrenia, because people living in Zagreb, they want to pretend that there is a normal life, they're trying to go on with a normal life. But there is also some psychological thing that happened, you know, with my friend Dražena, and I think it's even more indicative. It's more important for me because it indicates the change that happened to me during the 1 year of war, you know.
What happened?
What happened to me is that she came to my house, and my daughter, my grown-up daughter, she's 23, she gave her a pair of shoes, a pair of high-heeled patent shoes, you know, the shoes that you kind of wear it to the party. It's not the normal shoes. It's a nice pair of shoes. And then when she left the house, Dražena, my friend, I asked my daughter, but why did you give her that pair of shoes? She doesn't need such a shoes. And my daughter burst out, you know, she was very angry with me. She said, but how could you say such a thing? Do you think that because she's a refugee, she's not a normal woman? No, it's on the contrary that she needs to feel normal. She needs to have these kind of things, you know. And why, after all, do you expect all refugees why not to walk not only in sneakers but barefooted? And then you start to think about the perception. How come that I put my friend into category of the refugees, which is a broad category, which is a common denominator, you know? As soon as we accept this division, you know, between us and them, us non-refugees and them refugees, we are also ready to accept any other kind of division. And this is how once we start to divide, you know, there could be any kind of divisions, and it could be division on Germans and Jews, on enemies and friends, on inside enemies, outside enemies, you know. All kind of divisions are possible, and then this, you have this concept of otherness arising, and you can feel it in you. And this is the point when I realized that, you know, the war came to me. It is inside me. It's not only a mythical animal coming, approaching me slowly, but it is in me, in my way of being a conformist, in my way of collaborating with the war, of saying, well, just if I'm safe, if I'm okay, if my friends are okay, then everything is okay, you know. But I just can't take it all. I cannot take the sins of whole the world, you know. And this is this feeling, you know, that somehow I failed with Dražena, that somehow, you know, I didn't do everything because I was so ready to deny her personality, you know. She became a refugee, you know, reduced her to the common denominator, and I think this is when I realized that I have changed too.
What kind of assistance would you like to see the United States and European countries giving? What do you think those countries' responsibilities
are? Are you speaking now on a strictly political level?
Well, I'm speaking actually more probably on a military level.
Well, it's political level. I don't like United States coming in as a big policeman of the world, you know. But the thing is that at this point, I don't think anyone could stop these people destroying Sarajevo, destroying Bosnia and Herzegovina. There is no one. Europe is too weak. Europe is not united. Europe cannot act as if Europe, you know, EC hands are tied up. And they are not really acting. Even, you know, Mitterrand went there, you know, and it was very demonstrative. It was a very brave act. But what happened after there is that, you know, the airport opened, but the war didn't stop. Now, Dražena is right now sitting in my garden again. And what she told me, she came in tears. And she told me that via Paris, via one fax from Paris, she heard that five people from her paper have been killed last night, five journalists from her paper. Their chief editor is now without one leg, you know, and five other people have been killed. It means that the war, it happened last night. The Sarajevo was burning last night. The war goes on. Humanitarian aid is okay, it's good, it's wonderful, but it's not the end of the war, you know.
What makes us different from a civil war that another country would not want to intercede in?
Because I don't think it is a civil war. It is a war between two states. It's not a civil war. It's not this keep happening. We cannot see it any longer in terms of happening within one country, which is Yugoslavia. There is no Yugoslavia. There are separate countries. And I think that the most dangerous thing is that it's very hard to realize are two things. One is that this war could spill over the borders of ex-Yugoslavia into Greece, into Macedonian question is a very burning question. And then there is Greece, there is Albania there, you know, there is Bulgaria and so on and so on. The other thing is, I think, and it is absolutely on the more, you know, on a more psychological and subconscious level, is that Europe doesn't want to name it, doesn't want to say there is a war going on in Europe, because there is this idea that it couldn't happen again in Europe, that we have learned everything from during the Second World War, and now what is happening is only a civil war, not a major war in Europe. You know,
yeah.
No one wants to see that. No one wants to name it, because if you once again say this is a war in Europe, then it puts in danger every single country and its borders.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Croatian journalist Slavinka Draculic, and she's now contributed to The Nation, and she's the author of the collection of essays How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, and of the new novel Holograms of Fear. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Slavinka Draculic, who's talking to us from her home in Zagreb. Are you thinking of leaving Zagreb and going, for instance, to the United States, where I know you have a lot of friends and colleagues?
Well, you know, every time when I come to the United States, they always tell me, please stay, don't go there, it's too dangerous. But, you know, it's very difficult to leave the country. It's, I think, one of the most difficult decisions one can bring into life. You really have to feel threatened, you know. What I feel is that, you know, Zagreb is functioning pretty normally. And I'm a journalist and I'm a writer. And this is my language and this is where I belong. And it's very hard for me to leave. And I have seen so many of my colleagues, you know, who left. And they were suffering, really, you know. And I thought, well, you know, this is, how can I go away? I mean, it's very difficult to leave. I'm living here. I'm traveling a lot. This is the truth. But I'm living here and I'm writing about it. I just wrote a book about the war. And this is the best way for me to somehow fight back, you know, the whole situation. This is what, this is how I fight the war. And this is my kind of, you know, fighting the war, you know, by writing. And I don't think that you can sit anywhere else and write about it, but you have to sit here. You can't write a book about the war by sitting somewhere else, right?
I've always thought that there was a certain magic in being able to understand when that moment is right before it's too late to get out, you know, right before you're going to be physically threatened.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I think this was the big question for me was how the Jews during the Second World War, didn't they see it coming? Why didn't they go away? Why didn't they? I mean, it was very clear what was happening. Now, when you look back at, of course, it was really clear what was happening, you know. But I think it is very difficult to judge when is the right moment. And I think, of course, your life might depend on that. But it is very personal decision. It is very personal. No one can help you in that. You are entirely on your own, and it is so frightening to be entirely on your own. What I find for me is the most difficult thing in this war is the loneliness, you know. I have never been so much alone in my life. I've been utterly, totally, devastatingly alone in this war because I don't think that this kind of fear, this kind of suffering, this kind of a change that the person is going through, there is no one else can understand you, only the people who are going through that too, you know. So I think, I don't know, about the moment to go, yes, it is very difficult to decide, and we have to decide, I mean, every single person for herself, you know.
But well, you're a mother, too. How old is your daughter now?
My daughter is not living here.
Oh, she's not?
No, she's not. She lives, for a year now, she lives in Austria. I couldn't bear the idea that she would live here under the circumstances we are living, I told her to go. I told her to go, and I'm very often thinking, did I make a mistake? Maybe I should, you know. Of course, she's grown up enough to decide on her own, you know. But I was the one who was so much frightened for her, even if she's a woman, not a man. She didn't have to carry a gun. But I was really devastated by mere thought that she would stay here. And then when I saw that she's cracking, that she's just, you know, she couldn't stand this situation psychologically, I advise her to go away, so she's not living here.
You must miss her a lot.
Well, this is one of the reasons that, you know, that I am relieved by this fact, but also this is one more thing that makes me, you know, even more lonely.
Yeah.
Also, there is now a gap between me and her because she doesn't understand what I'm going through.
Right. Are most of the men you know in the military now?
Yes, they are. Just today, a friend of mine told me that her boyfriend is going to Dubrovnik, and she was crying on the phone. So there are daily these kind of scenes, you know, somebody is going or somebody got hurt or wounded or something like that. Most of the men are in the military, yes.
How is it changing the community that you live in to have a lot of the men gone? Are women doing different things than they've usually done?
No, not really, you know, not in Zagreb. Not in Zagreb. Women are doing what they have been doing, you know, they're keeping their jobs and their, but their personal life has changed. These people are totally different now. They are frightened. You can't talk to them. I mean, it's as if someone, you know, the change is so deep, you know, the fear is so deep that it's very, very, very hard to come across, you know. And the other thing is that what for me has been a big change is that the people, the fact that we think politically differently, it means that we cannot be friends any longer. So I thought that I have much more friends than I have. All of a sudden you realize there are only a few people you can communicate to because politically we are different. There are differences, very sharp political differences now, you know.
What are the kind of political differences that have divided you from old friends?
National homogenization. Because I think, you know, the stage of national homogenization that I can accept is not, I mean, I can't go that far as they are, you know. The pressure to nationally homogenize, you know, to antagonize, it's so strong, and I cannot accept it, you know. I just cannot be reduced only to my nation. And when I oppose to that, when I write about that, when I criticize, and then I say that, being reduced just to only one dimension, and this is the nation, for me is not enough, I don't feel good about that, then I'm even by some of my friends seen as a traitor. So it's very painful for me.
As a traitor to your country?
Yeah.
So what do they want, just Croats in Croatia? Or is it, what exactly do they want nationalistically? Your friends who you've split with.
Well, it's not that. The thing is that if 1/3 of the country, I can understand it perfectly. If 1/3 of the country has been occupied, and if 10,000 people have been killed and 500,000 displaced, what they are saying is, well, you know, you can save your criticism for later. If you're a good Croat, and this is a question: who is good and who is not good Croat, or who is better Croat? You should condemn the aggression. You should say that Croatia has been attacked, and so on, so on. Which I am doing. It's not a problem. The problem is, however, that this government has been clever enough to manipulate in the way public opinion, in the way that it identified the government with the people, you know, with Croatia, which I don't think it's the case. So if I criticize this government, it doesn't mean that I'm criticizing Croatia or that I'm not on the side of the people, you know. But this equation is very commonplace here. I mean, it's just a normal thing, you know. So if you criticize the government, they're saying, oh, no, I mean, why you are doing this? You are against Croatia. I'm not against Croatia. And, of course, Croatia, 1/3 of territory has been, you know, occupied, and we have been attacked by Serbian army. And so many people have been killed, and this and that. But it doesn't mean that we all have to be, you know, so nationally homogenized.
My guest is journalist Slavinka Drakulic, who's joining us from her home in Zagreb, Croatia. How is your health? I know years ago you had a kidney transplant. Is the war affecting you getting what you need for your health?
Well, we have difficulties with getting the medications. For not only for transplant patients, but for all patients, because the hospitals are full, and the kind of aid that is coming, medical aid, is in terms of medication, is more for, you know, wounded and antibiotics and these kind of things, and so we have difficulties in getting, for example, cyclosporin. Today I went to the hospital and they gave me only one bottle of cyclosporin, which is only for 10 days. And then in 10 days I have to come and see if there is more of cyclosporin, because they have to be very careful with that. It's a very expensive medication and they don't have it enough. So you are waiting every 10 days. Is it going to come more in donations or not? So this is one of the very, also one of the existential fears brought to me by the war, you know. But I'm not complaining about that. I hope, you know, there will be, and I hope the, you know, people will send in the medications for transplant patients.
What would happen if you didn't get it? I mean, what do you need it for? What does it do for you?
Oh, it is the cyclosporin and imuran and prednisone are keeping your kidneys staying in your organism. They are anti-rejection drugs.
I see.
You don't take them regularly. It means only that you are going to lose your organ, you know, so you have to be very careful. You have to take either combination of this medication or one medication. Depends. It's individual for each patient, and I'm getting all three kind of medications. I was very, very afraid before in October and November last year that I'm not going to get these medications, you know, because the reserves were very, very low and it was not coming in, you know. So it's coming in very small doses, and I think everybody's getting it for now, but everybody is you know, very, very scared about it. It's one of the fears that you have to learn to live with.
Are you preparing for the possibility of fighting in Zagreb? Do you think that that's a possibility?
It couldn't be excluded. It couldn't be excluded. Not in one moment. It could the war could escalate not only to Zagreb but to all Croatia and even to Slovenia. The war is not over. It's not ended. It's very dangerous, and I think we just shouldn't delude ourselves or lie to ourselves saying it's over and Zagreb is out of danger or it's not going to spread more to the west. It could. It could, and it all depends, really, is someone going to say, that's enough. Let's stop it. Let's finish with that. It's just going too far.
Are you doing anything to prepare for that possibility of more fighting?
Well, you can't do anything about that. You can't. You know, the city is a big trap. There is nothing. I mean, all civilians are armed. I'm unarmed, of course. And you just couldn't do anything. You can't foresee it. You know, it's difficult. You are just only hoping, sitting there and hoping, nothing going to happen. But this is exactly what happened in Sarajevo. People were sitting there and hoping nothing will happen, and this is what is happening to them. I think that Zagreb has a better chance of staying out of the fight. But the war could progress, could go more to the south, which is Macedonia, of course, and Kosovo and Albania. But it could also go more to the west. And I mean, I don't think that any possibility at this stage could be excluded.
One last question: what's the worst part of the day for you? The part where you worry the most?
Oh, well, it's the night. It's very difficult, because I have terrible nightmares. And also it's very difficult, it's frightening to go to sleep because, somehow while you're awake, you have this crazy idea, if something happens, you can still find a way out or do something. But it's about 3 o'clock in the morning that is probably between 3 and 4 or 3 and 5 in the morning. It's the worst part of the, actually it's not part of the day, it's part of the night, when you are afraid the most, you're afraid to fall asleep because you don't know what will happen or what will the next day bring. But I'm not complaining. I don't want you to understand that I'm complaining because there are much, much worse cases than, I mean, I don't consider myself to be even the case or anything, I'm just articulating, I think, the fears of the other people too, which is...
Yes.
Somehow my task as a writer,
Yes.
It's not, I'm surviving.
Right. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Journalist Slavinka Dragulic spoke with us from her home in Zagreb. She's the author of How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, and a new novel called Holograms of Fear. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.